I'd like to introduce our main speaker tonight. I give you Steve R. from the Courage to Change group of NA in the Santa Clarita area.
That's right. Thanks, Jason. Hi, my name's Steve. I'm an addict.
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
My home group is Courage to Change, one of about 35,000 NA groups that are called Courage to Change. We're one of them. And we meet on Thursday night in Newhall, California, which is the northern part of Los Angeles County. Of course, we haven't been meeting face-to-face for a while now, but we meet virtually. And if you're interested in attending, would love to have you. Let me know. I'll share the link with you. Thanks, Jason, for asking me to come and share. And, you know, I am a Southwest Pennsylvania boy. I got clean in Pittsburgh. And I got some people here tonight who are dear friends with, you know, many decades. Lance, I remember Lance walking into Better Change on Sunday night. I know this might be hard to believe, as cynical and untrusting as you can imagine. Now I know that's not the Lance that you all know, but that's the Lance that I saw when he showed up. And then, Kevin came in. Kevin's here tonight too. Hey, Kevin. And, Kevin was a young man, when he showed up here, and now he's not so young. And my daughter's here. My daughter's here, and my daughter used to come with me to many NA events, and, you know, should tag along and, you know, have one ear on the stories and, you know, listen to all that lovely language that we all use in meetings. And then when the day came that she realized that she had a problem, had a situation, she knew where to come. And so now she's a member, and she's coming up on 15 years clean. And that is pretty cool. And then there's Richard, and, good to see you, Richard. I'm not sure if there's anybody else that I know. If there is, nice to see everybody. It is nice to see everybody. My wife's sitting here with me, and, you know, she commented, she remarked on the energy that's in the meeting. And I really appreciate that. One of the things that I appreciate is, you know, when people deliberately, with intention, create this kind of, you know, community. And, you know, it's a little easier face to face than it is, this way, but, you know, we still have this opportunity, and I'm grateful for it. Thanks for that. You know, it's an interesting thing, this whole situation. I serve on my convention committee on the San Fernando Valley Area Convention Committee. Like somebody else was talking about, I think Aaron was talking about it earlier today. They actually trust me with the money. Imagine that. We had our first meeting in March, the very first weekend in March. So, you know, before, you know, the proverbial shit hit the fan for us, where there's 50 of us in this meeting room. And, we're going over budgets and talking about who's going to do what, and, you know, all kinds of wonderful, great ideas. And some guy in the very back of the room raises his hand, and he says, this virus might still be around in January. And again, this was the beginning of March. And, we all kind of laughed at him and told him to sit down and keep coming back. And, you'll learn as you stay here. And of course, a week later, you know, he proved to be right, and the rest of us were all wrong, and we've been living that reality ever since. And so, and of course, some of us surrender more quickly than others. So it took us a few months as a committee to finally decide that we are not going to meet face to face because we can't. And, surrender comes hard in some situations. And so, we are intending to do the same thing you folks are doing this year, and that is try to have a virtual event. And you know, that's what those are the opportunities that we have today. So I sat in on a couple of meetings, and it was great to hear folks who had an opportunity to share. So thanks to all those guys and ladies who did that. I think my last time I was at this retreat was in 2001. I left Pittsburgh in May of 2002. I'm pretty sure the last one I was at was 2001. And, I'd get there pretty regularly, I think. You know, Kevin may not remember better than me, or maybe Lance, but I'm pretty sure it was a regular thing for us. And, you know, I'd get up there at least for Saturday, and I always enjoyed the retreat. Hope you have an opportunity to do it again face to face next year. So I called my sponsor, you know, because I got asked to share, and I called my sponsor, and I said, I'm tired of telling the stories. I'm really tired. You know, the journey continues, and certainly, you know, as I walk through life, new opportunities arise, new challenges I'm faced with, and gifts continue to come, and it's an adventure. But the past is the past. It doesn't change. You know, I've been telling these stories for 34 years now, and they're the same stories. And I said that to him. I said, I want to talk about steps. I want to talk about service. I want to talk about traditions. I want to talk about sponsorship. And he said, yeah, but, you know, some people like the stories. And so, you know, tell a couple of stories. And so I'm going to tell a couple of stories, and I'm going to apologize to the guys that have heard them already, because, you know, they're the stories. They're the same stories. And, I get clean in August of 1986. I'm 34 years clean. I just celebrated 34 years clean. I'm 63, going to be 64 years old. I got clean when I was 29. I started using with my cousin Danny when I was, I think, 12 years old. We got a quart of Wellwood contact cement and a couple of brown paper bags, and went up in the woods, and did what you do, poured the glue in the bag, put the bag on our face, and held the vapors until we were unconscious. And it did something. I don't know what it did, but it did something. And, you know, from there forward, I never remember turning down a drug. There's a few I didn't do, but it's because they didn't come in front of me. From the time I was 12 to the time I was 29, I never remember turning down a drug. Some was good, more was better, and too much was just right. And I always knew when I was done, I was unconscious in the emergency room, occasionally in jail. If the drug was present, I always used. And, you know, and if it was a drug like, you know, if it was a drug that I didn't like, I figured I needed more. And, you know, that, you know, sometimes that worked, and, you know, sometimes it had unforeseen consequences. Along the way, I was not a successful drug addict. I wasn't successful in that my appetite always exceeded my ability to procure, drugs. I could never get enough. I have friends, other people that were far better at doing the deal than I was. And, it was pretty miserable for me. I spent a lot of time just trying to get well. And, so I went along a long time, using, you know, until the unmanageability just became so great that I couldn't deny it anymore. You know, my wife, my first wife, I've been married twice. Let me just say a little bit there. I've had the opportunity to be married to, you know, two really decent individuals, not at the same time, one after the other. And I know, no polygamy here. One's enough for me. Trust me. One's enough for me. You know, my wife at that time had enough and, you know, told me I needed to get out. And so, you know, that's how I ended up, you know, making my way into recovery. But before that, there were a couple of things that happened along the way that really identify that I'm, you know, I'm an addict. And, you know, one of them is a story that, you know, I know, you know, we're not famous here in Narcotics Anonymous, but one of the things that, you know, that I'm known for is this story. And, you know, and the day that it happened, it was just another day. It was a winter time. It was February, in Pittsburgh. And so, you know what February is like in Pittsburgh. It's pretty much like in Lower Mountain Highlands. It's cold and snowy. I had wrecked my second car of that month. You know, I wrecked every car I ever owned, before I got clean. And, I wrecked two in a 10-day period back in February of 86. And so I didn't have any cars and I needed to cop. And so, you know, one of the things that I really love about, Zoom, about this whole virtual meeting thing is it really, underscores the, how adaptive we are. We are adaptable. Addicts are adaptable. And, you know, I was adaptable, we are adaptable in recovery. So that February day, I didn't have any cars. It was cold. It was wintertime and I needed to go cop. So, I went out in my garage and I had this old beat up garden tractor that my brother had given to me to cut the grass with, this Sears 15 horsepower garden tractor, yellow with, you know, with a headlight hanging off and the seat was all duct taped together. You know, it was pretty tore up. And, you know, I decided that was going to be my means of transportation. So I jumped on this garden tractor and I headed on, and you guys actually know this road. I headed on down Route 88. You guys know Route 88. And I headed down Route 88 on my garden tractor. And, you know, I remember driving on the road and my cousin, I got about 25 cousins back there, and my cousin Ricky, he saw me on the road and he pulled over. And he said, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, it's wintertime. It's February. You're driving your garden tractor along the side of the road. Where are you going? And, you know, I told him I was going to cop. And, you know, if he wanted to come, he's welcome. And, he shook his head and, you know, on he went. But the one moment I don't think I'll ever forget is, you know, my connection's name was John, and John was living in a little split level, three bedroom suburban home there in Bethel Park, and, you know, kind of keeping a low profile. And I come tooling in on my garden tractor in the middle of February, you know, and, you know, it doesn't have a muffler, the headlights hanging off, and I drive on to his front yard, and he comes out and standing at his front door with this, you know, with this look of disgust and disbelief. You know, he wanted to know what the fuck I was doing. And, you know, I told him I'm here to pick up my package. And, I don't remember much more after that, you know, because I went and I used and, you know, how that goes. Somehow or another, I made it home with that tractor. And, but, you know, again, that day, was just like any other day for me. It was just a day I just had to figure out how I was going to use. And so that's, you know, that's the solution I came up with. I had other solutions that weren't so colorful, that, you know, put my children in harm's way, certainly put me in harm's way, without regard for the health and welfare of anybody, really. My appetite for the drug exceeded all of my other, any principles or any, you know, any other concerns or responsibilities I had. I've heard other people say it, you know, when, you know, when the appetite to when the opportunity to use came on me, the obsession incited the obsession, and I had to use. So I'm going to tell one more quick story, and then I'll talk about recovery. A couple of years before the tractor incident, I was working in a restaurant, and we had a theft, and one of our dishwashers had stole a bunch of money out of the safe, and we knew who it was, and but my boss wanted to have all of those of us who were on the shift take a lie detector test, and so you know, we told everybody that was on the shift that night that they were going to have to take a lie detector test, and I volunteered to be the first one. I didn't have anything to hide. I was happy to take the lie detector test. And so the day came to take the test, and I got the phone call. I was at the restaurant. I got the phone call, and they said, come on up to this office. You're going to take the lie detector test. And before I left the building, I got another phone call from my partner. His name was Steve. And he said, I have a package. And I like to say I was presented with a dilemma. I knew Steve. Steve had the same appetite for the drug that I did. And Steve was not to be trusted with my package. I knew what would happen if I left my package with Steve for too long. I figured, let me just swing by. Just take me a minute. He was on the way. I'll swing by, I'll pick it up, and I'll go take the lie detector test. And once I got there, I had to, you know, check it to make sure it was the quality I was accustomed to. And I consumed some amount of that stimulant and then went on to take my lie detector test. Sat down. I don't know if you've ever taken a lie detector test. I've taken one. It's just like in the movies. They bring out this suitcase. They open up the suitcase, and there's this paper machine with a needle, and they put a blood pressure cuff on you, and they put some heartbeat stuff on your chest, and then they put a sweat monitor on your finger, and they start asking you questions. I mean, it's just like in on TV. They start asking me questions like, what's your name and where do you live? Hard questions, questions that really required some, honesty. And the needle's doing this, and I'm sweating my brains out. My eyes are bugging out of my head. And these two guys are looking at me across the desk from me. What are you doing? They didn't ask me the real questions. They ended up unhooking the machine and sent me on my way, and I got fired, and that was the end of that. I gotta tell you, it is, for me, it's a great story about denial and how we believe our own bullshit. I mean, every step of the way on that day, I lied to myself, and believed it. You know, when I left the restaurant, I believed I was just going to pick it up. When I stopped at Steve's, I believed I was just going to have a taste. When I got to take the lie detector test, I believed I was okay. One of the things I love, it's taken me a long, long time to come to this awareness with the first step. Cause I used to get kind of distracted by, powerlessness and distracted by unmanageability. And certainly there's a lot to be said about powerlessness and unmanageability. But what I need to remember is we admit it. That's what I need to remember. We admit it. I don't admit much. Everybody in the room knew I was an addict. Anybody I worked for, family members, the lady standing in front of me in the grocery store, everybody knew I was an addict. The only one who wasn't admitting that I was an addict was me. I do believe that our steps are written as simply as they were intended to be written, where we're intended to be understood as simply as they were written. We admit it for me. Is just critical. I believe my own lies. I have for my entire life. I mean, even before I was use them. I can remember coming up with stories that I thought were good and I believed them. And I told them long enough that I thought they were true. So eventually I did. Eventually I got clean. I ended up in a detox. I ended up in a treatment center out there in Aliquippa. And of course they took us all down to the Double Bubble. That was my first NA meeting was Double Bubble. Dennis was there and Bob was there and Kathy from Steubenville spoke that night. And there was a great big 100-cup coffee pot back there that I drank 3 or 4 cups of. Cause we weren't allowed to have coffee in the treatment center. And there was a guy at the door and his name was Duncan, and he greeted us to his home group. He welcomed us to his home group. And he gave me my first Narcotics Anonymous hug that I remember. I don't know that I ever saw Duncan again, but I remember Duncan. I remember Duncan. I try to honor him with that recollection whenever I share, because the lesson in his simple act of welcoming me is deep and long lasting. And he's one of the people that taught me, about the responsibility of being a home group member and creating that same atmosphere of recovery that you guys have created in this meeting. And so it Courage to Change on Thursday night, when we meet face to face, I'm on the door. I'm on the door and welcoming you to my home group. I do that because Duncan did it. I did it because Chucky did it. Chucky, yes. I went to the beach view meeting. I'm getting beach view and Beachwood confused. I'm starting to forget the Pittsburgh terminology. Chucky was there and he also taught me that lesson of greeting people when they come to your meeting. And then my sponsor, Kenny, at the time, I complained to him about feeling uncomfortable in meetings. I felt uncomfortable in meetings for a long, long time. If you're new and you feel uncomfortable in meetings, it's okay. I felt uncomfortable in meetings for a long, long time. I think so many of the things that we are asked to do here, while they are simple, they are extremely uncomfortable and really confusing for us. And going to meetings early on was tough for me. And what my sponsor told me at the time was, he solidified this lesson by saying, be the greeter at your home group. Welcome people to your meeting. And like so many things that my sponsors have told me over the years, I thought, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. How's that going to help me? And I always know when something's going to be good. Really, really life changing. I've got that insight, because the first thing I think of is, that's the stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard. That's like a red light indicator, bells are going off that this is going to be a life changing event because it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Which, by the way, second step. Open-mindedness. And the first step for me is really, it's about honesty. It's about self-honesty, but it's about admitting that I can't trust my own information. And the evidence of not being able to trust my own information is unmanageability. I think it's in the step working guide that it says that unmanageability is evidence. And the second step is about open-mindedness. I need to be willing to consider information from outside of myself. And so even though I do still have that thought that that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, I take action on that information. I exercise my third step. I'm willing to do that. I have the willingness to take the action on the information provided to me. And I started greeting people at the Do It Now group that used to meet up at the monastery on Wednesday at noon. It changed my membership in that meeting. It made me feel comfortable. It took a little bit of the edge off for me. And I've been doing it ever since. I do it to honor Duncan. I do it to honor the lesson that Kenny was trying to teach me. And I do it because I know there's other people like me who are extremely uncomfortable coming into a meeting. And if I can help take that edge off just a little bit for them to come into the meeting, I'm happy to do that. So I got these five things that I've identified that are my tenants, are my measurable tenants. I, you know, for me, this is a program of action. You know, I tell the guys that I sponsor, especially the new guys, because they want to, not all of them, but some of them want to, you know, they want to go on and on about, you know, a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of drama. And I'm not, I don't mean to discount it or, but I don't have much drama in my life these days. I'm, you know, I, you know, my biggest drama is I can't get my dog to poop on the wood. He keeps on pooping on the gravel, and I wish you could get him to poop on the wood, you know? And, you know, that's a drama in my life. Or I can start my car, but my wife can't. For some reason or another, my car won't start for my wife. That's my drama. But you know, they come with a fair amount of drama. And you know, what I've come to understand is it doesn't matter how you feel. It doesn't matter how I feel. It doesn't matter even what I think. I mean, those things matter on some level, but for this program to work, for the program to work, for the program of Narcotics Anonymous to work, it's absolutely dependent on what I do. It's not dependent on my intentions. It's not dependent on, again, what I think or how I feel. It's dependent on what I do. And somehow or another, even though I couldn't articulate that early on, I learned that early on. I knew going to meetings was really important. I mean, I got it. You guys were telling me 90 and 90, and I got it. And, you know, I went to meetings every day for a long time. And, you know, I'm still good for 2 or 3 meetings a week. Even now in this environment, I'm still good for 2 or 3 meetings a week. NA members go to meetings. That's what we do. And I don't care that I don't like it. There's a guy at one of the meetings I go to, and he was complaining about the virtual meetings. He said, you know, he said, they're kind of like bad dope. He said, they work. You just got to do a lot of them. And I thought that was pretty funny, and appropriate. But I go to meetings, and I don't have to like going to meetings. I didn't like going to meetings when I first got here. I didn't, you know, I guys I sponsor, I check in with them. They check in with me, and I say, are you going to meetings? He says, I don't like those virtual meetings. Well, I didn't like going to meetings when we were face to face. When I first got clean, I hated going to meetings. My gut would wrench when it came time to go to meetings, but I went to meetings. And I stayed clean. And, you know, this isn't about smart or skilled, or this is just about following a little bit of direction. And one of my measurable tenets is meetings. I measure myself against my meetings all the time. When's the last time I went to a meeting? When's the next time I'm going to a meeting? Sponsorship is a second tenant. Sponsorship is a second tenant. I have a sponsor. I know who he is. I know the last time I talked to him. I'm going to see him tomorrow morning. We're going to be in a meeting together. You know, I talk to him on a regular basis. And I sponsor guys. You know, I'm available as a sponsor. And, you know, one of the things I learned about sponsorship recently, and I really love this lesson, because it really hadn't sunk in for me until recently, is that these guys I sponsor, not only do I have the responsibility to be present for our relationship, as I've heard others talking about today, I have responsibility to help them become a sponsor for other guys. There'll be a time if things go the way they're supposed to around here that they'll be sponsoring guys, or maybe they already are. And you know, I have a responsibility to the guys that they sponsor, to help them be as good as they can be as a sponsor. And you know, I learn lessons from the guys I sponsor on how to sponsor, just like I try to, share with them my experience about sponsorship. I heard a guy call his sponsees, he said, I don't call them sponsees, I call them sponsors in training. And, I thought that was an interesting perspective, and maybe one that I hadn't heard enough about, around here in all the years that I've been here. So, you know, I lean into that now with the guys that I sponsor. And, you know, I don't always wait for them to call me. You know, there's nothing wrong with me calling them and, seeing how they're doing and checking in with them. Meeting sponsorship steps. So, you know, I talked a little bit about, the first three steps: honesty, open-minded, and willingness. Our honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are indispensable. And I believe for me, they are the core principles of those first three steps that fit together you know, the relationship between those first three steps, there are three components of one process that reminds me that I can't trust my own thinking. I need to go seek information from sources outside of myself, whether that be a loving God or my sponsor or literature or anywhere, the library, you know. Facebook might not be a good place, but hey, you know, maybe it is, I'm not sure. And then the willingness and, you know, the third step, I think it's a basic text talks about willingness implies action. And my third step is about action. I exercise my third step, when I'm taking action on the information provided to me. And I always know, when I'm doing that, because, you know, that process is the process of surrender for me. Surrender for me, my definition of surrender is doing what I don't want to do. It took me a long time to kind of get to that place where I understood surrender to be that for me. When I first came here, I couldn't stay clean for a few months. And, you know, my sponsor kept telling me, you know, you got to surrender. You got to surrender. And, you know, I was going around old people places and things. I was, you know, I had a little bit of the chemical stashed. There were some things that I was doing that wasn't in line with what we recommend around here. And I couldn't stay clean. What a surprise. And until I finally was willing to surrender to the recommendations that were being offered to me, until I was able to do that, then I finally was able to stay clean. Six and seven are another thing for me. I mean, when I first got here, I looked at four and five and nine were the ones that really scared the shit out of me. I mean, I really didn't want to tell anybody my secrets. There was some stuff that, you know, I did and stuff, some stuff that was done to me that, you know, I was taken to the grave. I was taken to the grave. Unless I got really, really high and we started telling stories. I mean, there used to be those, you know, those 4 o'clock in the morning stories. I don't know if you guys ever did that, but, you know, we used to at 4 o'clock in the morning, we start trying to shock one another and say, you know, oh yeah, well this would, you know, and, yeah, anyways. But besides that, I wasn't telling anybody. And nine meant paying people back. And I wasn't paying anybody back. I figured we were even. And I looked at six and seven. They were so abstract to me. I'm not a guy who has a really strong God identity. And so, you know, I saw those steps and the way I read those steps was there was going to be some divine, shower. That would come upon me someday and wash me of these defects of character. And, you know, I would be in the light and, you know, with the white robe. I mean, it just felt so much like a religious experience to me that I knew that would never be available to me. And then I did it with my sponsor. I had a sponsor named Steve, wonderful man. He died a few years back, just a wonderful man. And he taught me this lesson about six and seven and it changed my life. And you guys might have trouble finding it, because it's hidden, you know, it's hidden. And, you know, the best place to hide this kind of information, from addicts, right? You hide it in the literature. You hide it in the literature because they'll never look there. And, at least it was hidden from me for a long, long time. It was hidden from me in the literature. And in the process of six and seven, I am an active participant in my relief from defects of character, in my relief from acting out on shortcomings. I've gone through this exercise of dissecting my defects, becoming intimately aware of those that I am ready to be aware of. Cause, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. That kind of thing for me has been a part of my six and seven step process. There's an exercise of dissecting my defects and understanding when and where they show up in my life and then looking at the contrasting spiritual principles and then aspiring to those principles. you know, a very basic way is, you know, I've got problems with call centers. I don't know if you guys got problems with call centers, but when I get on a call center, I have a resentment before I get the first three numbers dialed. I'm already pissed off at the person and she hasn't even picked up the phone. He hasn't even, I'm already ready to hang up on him and I haven't even dialed the number. And I know that about me. And so, you know, that intolerance, that impatience that I have, those, that defect that I have that shows up every time I call a call center is a situational defect. And so I've learned before I pick up that phone, I ask for patience, I ask for tolerance, I ask for kindness. And so aspiring to those things is what is an empowerment for me. It empowers me. And I do better now. I do better on those. And now recently I found a new trick, that I do, when I call one of them, because we're in this circumstance and so many call centers are, you know, service providers of one sort or another. I mean, these people are dealing with, you know, just all kinds of problems associated with the pandemic. The first thing I'll do is I'll thank them for their service. In the same way, you know, I might thank you for your service, for serving on a convention committee or on a retreat committee. And I say, you know, first of all, let me just say, I get that you're probably having a rough couple of months and thanks for coming to work every day. Boy, you can't imagine the level of service you get from somebody when you thank them. It is just amazing how kind they can be. I'm 63 years old, going to be 64. It's taking me this long to figure it out. So, that's 6 and 7 step work. That is what 6 and 7 step looks like in my life today. That is meaningful. That is so much more powerful than the secrets I was going to die with and the money I owed to my cousin Paul. You know, that shit is just, that is lost in the dust compared to these things that, these empowerments that allow me to interact with the world around me in a way where I'm not in conflict even before I'm in contact, right? I would be in conflict with somebody even before I was in contact with them. So meetings, sponsorship steps, service. Service is the fourth tenet of my program. And, you know, like some others, I got lost in service early on. I dove into service because it was where I found the opportunity to be busy. And, you know, if I'm good, maybe you'll let me stay and, you know, maybe you'll like me. And, it was the way I found my presence in NA. And, this is another one. It's taken me a long time to figure out why we're supposed to do service. I thought we were supposed to do service because I knew why I was supposed to do service because I was smart. And you guys needed to hear what I had to say. Because, if you just listen to me, we'd get this done a lot quicker, a lot cheaper. And if you would just let me do it, it would be even better. If I didn't, and of course, many other people came to the table with exactly that same perspective, and there was a lot of head crashing. Early on, when a couple of guys asked me to share at their home groups, and after about the fifth or sixth one that introduced me this way, well, you know, the first time I met Steve, I didn't like him. We was in a service meeting and, I found him to be offensive and overbearing. And, after a little while, he grew on me. And, that was the reflection that I was, seeing, of myself in their experience with me. It made me uncomfortable, but it was the reality that, I was abrasive, offensive but I was right. And boy, for me, that meant a lot. Being right was a big deal. It was a big deal. It still is sometimes. And so here's the lesson I've learned. And this is another one of those, I just can't believe it, lessons. But we think the reason why we get involved in service is to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. And certainly that is a byproduct of getting involved in service. But I believe now, today, for me, the reason why I need to be involved in service is because I still need to learn to get along with others. That's what service is about, learning how to get along with others. That's what it's about for me. Going to the convention committee 34 years later, I still have to ask for patience and tolerance and kindness when I go into that convention committee meeting. And even with that, I'm likely to act like an asshole if I'm not careful. It's about learning how to get along with others. Our first tradition, how long am I going here, Jason? If you could just give me something in the chat, sir, I appreciate it. Our first tradition, I have this vision of when the traditions were written. You know, the traditions were written before NA was formed. Our predecessors, just like it says in the basic text, our predecessors through their hard-fought experience, whatever that terminology is in the traditions reading that somebody read. So I can just see him sitting around a table in the late 40s with coffee and cigarettes and saying, okay, we need to write a few things down here because we're going to die. And we've learned some lessons along the way. And so let's write down some stuff that help people avoid. You know, I believe my steps are an effort to get me to do things I'm not inclined to do. My steps are an effort to get me to do things I'm not inclined to do. I'm not inclined to be honest. I'm not inclined to be open-minded. And I'm not inclined to be willing. I'm not inclined to look at my defects of character. I'm not inclined to, my 12-step reminds me that I need to stick around and help others. And I'm not inclined to do that all the time. I get mine, but, my 12-step reminds me that, okay, you got yours, now help somebody else get theirs. My steps are an effort to get me to do things I'm not inclined to do. I believe that the traditions are an effort to help us avoid doing things we are inclined to do. And when I look at them that way, they're less confusing. The message that's intended comes through more clearly. And the message of the first tradition, I'm certain of this. I just know this is true, that they looked around, they said, okay, what's the first thing we're going to tell these people after we're gone? Well, you're going to fight a lot. You're going to fight a lot. That's what their message was to us. You're going to fight a lot. And unity is paramount. Who's right isn't what's most important. And I know the reason why they told us that we were going to fight a lot is because they fought a lot. There probably weren't 100 groups back then and maybe 1,000 members. And you can guarantee that they were fighting a lot, because we are impassioned. I never met an NA member that doesn't love Narcotics Anonymous. I never met an NA member that doesn't believe NA saved their lives. I mean, we all believe that. And we all want to carry the message. Our fifth tradition is something we all own in the same way we own our name. And we come to those tables impassioned with that. Those who struggle with being right like I do bring that to the table also. Throw in a little bit of control and a little bit of closed-mindedness, and there's a lot of headbutting that goes on. And especially in these times, we're in a situation where there's a great deal of uncertainty. I'm going to wind up here. There's a great deal of uncertainty in our world. On so many levels, and we need one another. We need one another in ways that we're not even sure about yet. And so, should the meeting be face to face? Should we be wearing masks? Should we be, all these things, yes, no, I think it's all bullshit. It's not, all that stuff goes on, and it ends up affecting our relationships with one another. And, one of the first meetings I went to was the Brookline meeting on Wednesday night. I was sitting in the meeting. The meeting was just getting started. Two guys started a fight out in the parking lot. The meeting emptied out because we all wanted to go see the fight. Nobody wanted to stay for the recovery. We all went to see the fight. I think that is such a simplistic example of how quickly we can be distracted. And how the newcomer is affected by that. That was like my fourth or fifth meeting. I needed to be in the meeting. I did not need to see another fist fight. God knows I've seen enough of those. But I went to the fist fight. Personal recovery depends on NA unity in so many ways. You know, this is all going to end sometime. I mean, the political situation is going to—it's going to end sometime. There'll be some sort of calming of the waters with that, and we'll be left with one another. We'll be left with one another. And if we damage those relationships now, that damage, the residue of that damage will affect us after that. So I really try to be mindful of that. So that was meeting, step, service, sponsorship. And the last thing I'm going to talk about is prayer. And I'm only going to talk about that for a second. You know, up until just recently, you know, I used to say I'm not a big God guy. And I was in a meeting with my sponsor and my current sponsor and you know, he was sharing, and what I realized, and he's got a strong relationship with the God of his understanding, and what I realized at the time was, you know, that open-mindedness that I talk about with the second step, I wasn't exercising in the way that benefited my recovery. I was restricting myself in ways that were not beneficial. And so, you know, I've taken a different perspective on that. I mean, I used to say, and I still do this, you know, I pray every time I'm in a meeting, I pray twice, and at the beginning, at the end. I take a moment and attempt to engage, whatever's listening to offer some thoughts and, you know, ask for help for myself, ask for help for people who I believe need it. But more recently that those conversations have been a little bit more focused. And so, my first sponsor was identified as atheist at the time that he sponsored me. And I guess, at some point in the game, I said to him, Kenny, you know, you pray. I've seen you pray. When we got ready to do my fifth step, we prayed together. I said, you pray, but you're an atheist. I said, you know, why do you pray? And he said, well, I pray because the program tells me to pray. That's why I pray, because the program says we pray. And so again, back to that original statement of, you know, this is a program based on my actions, not on my intentions, not on what I think, not on what I believe, and not what I feel. And so, for me, meeting, steps, service, sponsorship, and prayer have been my tenets. They're what got me clean. They're what keep me clean. When I'm, you know, when my kids, and I got a bunch of them, we have a bunch of them. When one of them is making me crazy, you know, it's one of those five things that will likely bring me back to center. Although I had a sponsor that told me some very, very powerful information one time. He said, you know, sometimes the best thing you can do, Steve, is just leave the room. I never thought of that one. That one really escaped me for a long, long time. I thought you had to stay in, you know, until the wheels fell off, right? And sometimes the best thing you can do, and you know something? Sometimes the hardest thing to do is leave the room. I mean, I'll start engaging with one of my boys, and my wife will come over and put a hand on my shoulder, and you know what that means. Get out of here. And it's everything I can do when I can do it to turn around and just leave the room. You know, today I aspire to be kind and truthful. And those are two things that are, you know, they don't come easy. You know, lying is, my mother used to say, you'll lie when the truth will do. And it's, you know, sometimes it just comes out. My eighth and ninth step really helped me with that this time around. And, you know, cause this was another thing that my sponsor told me. He gave me this eighth step list and, or this eighth step worksheet. And the very beginning of the eighth step worksheet was, list the last 10 little white lies you told. I thought, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And, you know, and I went through that exercise of listing as many as I could remember. And, you know, what I learned about that was every time I lie, you may not know, but I do. And it's one more dent in myself, the way I see myself. One more opportunity for me to dislike myself, or dismiss myself in some way or another. Um, I think I'm just about at the end of my time. I got a bazillion stories about how my life has been enriched since I got here. What I've learned along the way is the real gifts are the relationships. You know, I was incapable of being available for any relationship before I got here. I was either loaded or looking to get loaded. And you know that life. And today, you know, I'm available. And while I don't always do them as well as I would like, I there's people in my life that I love and that, you know, that are that love me. And, you know, my children, my wife, the guys I sponsor, my friends, like some of the guys that are in the room here, you know, all of you have enriched my life in ways that I never, ever imagined. I mean, I just thought this was about not using. So that's it. Again, I thank you for inviting me. And next year, hopefully, we'll meet face to face. That's it. Thanks.